the week of June 3rd, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 412, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm your faithful correspondent, Michael Giltz.
Why do you say faithful?
Because I'm here every week, rain or shine. I am here ready to do the show. Sperling, however, not so much.
Okay, look, I have to go to Cine Europe. It takes place next week. It's like the CinemaCon of Europe. And unfortunately, I will not be available to do the show next week. And unfortunately, that's also, you know, the Tonys are on Sunday. So I know we want to cover that. But we're going to kind of cover it this week, right?
We are because everyone knows who is going to win the Tony Awards. It's the most suspense-free Tonys in ages. Maybe there's one or two secondary categories, but not a lot of excitement there in terms of who's going to win. But what matters there are the performances. So that we won't be able to cover. But, you know, we get all this information every week. We present it to you and we get barraged with emails and newsletters and text messages and Facebook posts. And sometimes they do make me laugh.
So which ones made you laugh this week?
Well, one from Hollywood Reporter. The headline said, Haley Steinfeld to star in Emily Dickinson comedy series for Apple.
So
a sitcom about Emily Dickinson, a sitcom about the Belle of Amherst. I mean, that's just this reclusive poet. And they're like, it's going to be hilarious.
Yeah.
You'll love the iambic pentameter. It's insane. It's going to have its set period. And it's going to have a modern sensibility and tone. What? I mean, anything's possible, but that's bizarre. And the other one that made me laugh came from Variety. It said, headline, James Marsden to star in Sonic the Hedgehog movie. Well, your career is set. Now you've gone from Westworld to Sonic the Hedgehog. It may be a great film. Maybe it's a really good adult. It's a combo of live action and animation. I'm sure it will be awesome.
Well, you know what wasn't awesome?
What?
Having to wait for hours and hours and hours to buy next year's Coachella tickets. You know, they put Coachella tickets on sale like a month after the show. You know, it's like 6 to 7 weeks after the 2018 show, and they're already putting tickets on sale for 2019. And of course, you have to buy 3-day passes, although they now have like single day passes. And they put them on sale. Now, how many years have they been selling tickets for this event?
How long has it been around?
It's been, you know, 1999 was the first one. And so it's been 20 years. And you'd think they'd know, the promoters, that this is probably going to be a heavy traffic day. And so they kind of put everybody in some virtual line, and there's this little walking man as you know, it looks like the man is walking in, you know, on your screen as it's walking further and further closer to the end goal. And then you fill out all the forms and you select your weekend and you do everything. And then you click submit to purchase the tickets and you get an error message. And you submit again and you get another error message. And you submit again and you get another error message. And now you don't want to go back in line because, of course, it just took 45 minutes to get to the point where you could purchase a ticket. And you're afraid that if you go back in line, well, you know, you might get thrown out or it might be sold out or, you know, you won't ever get back in. And so then you begin to wonder, wait, you've clicked submit how many times now? What if you now are the proud owner of 40 tickets to next year's Coachella? And it's not a cheap event, right? So in the end, of course, I get booted out because I've timed out. You have 10 minutes to purchase your ticket. I'm back in line. But then I said, you know what? I wonder if my credit card has been charged. And sure enough, it has been charged. Or at least there's a pending. Only once. And then I get a confirmation email about 2 hours later saying, congratulations on your purchase. It doesn't say what I've purchased. It doesn't say how many tickets I've purchased or how many. You know, just the whole thing. You'd think that out of all of the festivals in the world, there's like Glastonbury, there's Coachella, there's Bonnaroo. There's very few big giant festivals like this. You'd think they could get that right.
It's hard though, isn't it? I mean, the traffic on Harry Potter, I was stuck in a loop for 2 hours, afraid to, you know, refresh or go back because they'd say you'd lose everything. So, you know, clearly, though they know the demand is there and they want to be prepared, I assume it's just a question of technology, not their desire to be ready for it.
Yeah, I probably, actually. I would agree with that.
Okay. Well, what a first world white male incel problem you had getting tickets
funny,
to Coachella.
I realized that as I was saying all of this, I knew that
my limo is so expensive.
Right. It's so small compared to my neighbor's limo. Yeah, exactly.
Well, we know what you'll be doing in 2019, but we don't know what you'll be doing today on the show. So why don't you tell us?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're looking at the theatrical innovation taking place in China. While back in the U.S., Hollywood still hates the innovations of MoviePass. Nonetheless, they soldier along, and the first film they have a vested interest in was released in theaters. How did it do? We'll let you know. For the first time in history, the number one television show in America has been canceled by its network. If you're a celebrity and you're thinking about tweeting your thoughts on the whole Roseanne controversy, take our advice. Don't. During Book Filter, we have some mixed news about sales in Canada and some good news about sales in the U.S. Has the ebook format begun to grow again? On Inside Baseball, we'll take a close look at Broadway, as we mentioned. The Tonys take place on Sunday, and Michael will not so boldly predict the top four winners. We'll also look at sales overall, Broadway sales that is, and take a peek into the summer and fall with a new round of invest or not invest?
I guess invest sounds better.
Okay. Well, of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from all the trades and you, our viewers. If you wanted to get on the charts this week, there are 25 films. And at number 25, you needed to gross $1.1 million from all over the world. And so that's, the RBG, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg documentary, almost made the worldwide charts. It was like $40,000 less than Blockers, the film at number 25. That's the raunchy comedy. It's made $91 million worldwide, and it's chugging along. If you wanted to make the top 10 on ComScore, you needed to gross $4.4 million. That's where you'll find Upgrade. That's another Blumhouse horror flick, which stars Loan Marshall Green and, again, got kind of good reviews. Not only are they making these inexpensive, low-budget horror flicks, but they're actually getting pretty good reviews. So that's a great sign for their library down the road. That movie made $4.4 million. But if you wanted to be the number one movie in the world, you needed to gross $65 million. That's where you'll find not Han Solo, but Deadpool 2, the snarky merc with a mouth, grossed $65 million, and it's just passed $600 million worldwide. Big success for yet another Marvel film, this time from Fox.
Yeah, I don't know what to say about Solo. It plummeted 65% in the U.S. alone.
That's right. At number two around the world is Solo, A Star Wars Story. That grossed $60 million on the weekend. That's at $265 million worldwide. They said to themselves, all right, it didn't open great, but maybe word of mouth will be okay, or audiences will turn out. What's going to happen second weekend? And no, nobody showed up.
Yeah, I mean, I think really when you look at some of the parts of that movie, right, that you could clearly tell were directed by Lord and Miller, you were looking at a movie that, could have been somewhat fun. And then you kind of see where Ron Howard took over and you're like, okay, so you decided to go the safe route. Well, you know what? I don't know. I think maybe as much as you don't want to ruin the mythology of Star Wars, maybe the fun route was, maybe that was the way to go.
I don't know how you could tell who did what. I mean, 85% of the film was reshot. So I think it's almost all Ron Howard.
Little scenes and little snippets that you can really tell were not Ron Howard.
Okay. Well, at number three around the world, Disney is showing Disney how it's done. The Avengers Infinity War grossed another $35 million. By the end of next weekend, that will have passed the $2 billion mark worldwide. At number four is a Japanese animated film. It's the 38th in a series. It's Doraemon, the movie Nobita's Treasure Island. It's a very low budget flicks. This one opened to $23 million. I guess it opened in another territory. Maybe it's in China. It's at $75 million worldwide. And number five is How Long Will I Love You? The Chinese romantic time traveling drama. $16 million on the weekend. That's at $110 million. So is that the movie where there was some controversy about the ticket sales? They tend to blur for me, but in any case, this movie is proving audiences love it.
Well, this is, you know, I wanted to see this movie. I mentioned it last week. However, it's only showing in two theaters in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And this is the movie where they, you know, two people live in an apartment 18 years apart or 19 years apart, 1999. The man lives in the apartment in 1999, and the woman lives in the apartment in 2018, and they kind of connect through the closet door. Like, when they open the closet door, it's like they're in 1999 and or 2018, and it's one of those, like, love stories those impossible love stories.
Yes, that's what it is. I saw another review. It was mild. I don't think this is a particularly well-reviewed film, but I'd be interested to hear your reaction if you check it out. It's here in New York. Maybe I should go see it too. And number six is, but I did go to the movies this weekend. Did you see anything?
I did not see anything, and I wanted to go see, get this, I wanted to go see a movie that I think we're going to talk about, which is American Animals.
Oh, well, we certainly are going to talk, but you didn't see it.
I didn't see it. You know why? Well, I was going to use MoviePass. I was going to use MoviePass to go see it, okay? Because I wanted to show that, you know, if MoviePass does release a film, that you can go use MoviePass to see it, and that the whole system works, right?
Yes, it works. I use it all the time.
There's only one problem. In Los Angeles, where the film did quite well in both of the theaters that it was in, you could see the film at the Landmark, okay, which is on the west side, or at the Hollywood ArcLight. Only one of those two.
But ArcLight doesn't handle MoviePass, right?
Exactly.
They're a premium subscriber. Well, so what? It'll come out on more screens because it did pretty well.
Yes.
I went to see the silent film Seventh Heaven, starring Janet Gaynor, at the MoMA, which does not include MoviePass. And then I saw Clute, starring Jane Fonda, which was at Metrograph, which does accept MoviePass.
And I'm sure right now the people at MoviePass are like, we don't understand how this movie from the 70s is trending, you know.
it was almost sold out. It did great. It was a Jane Fonda in the 70s series at Metrograph, and it was jam-packed theater. I mean, they only seat like 50, 60 seats, but still.
And the Metrograph, it's one of Celluloid Junkie's, cinemas of the month, I think, in 2017.
Well, I would think it would be a cinema of the year. Great seats, great space, you know, a couple screens, art house movies, revival houses. It's great. It's a great addition to the New York repertory system, which has only got Film Forum, Movie Pass, and I mean, Movie Pass, Metrograph, and I guess MoMA, really.
What about IFC?
Well, they do retrospectives too, but not as much. They're more just a commercial first run theater to me.
Right.
You know, but there you go. Back to the box office. At number six is the Shailene Woodley film Adrift, $11 million on its opening weekend. At number seven is the South Korean remake Believer. That's a remake of Johnny To's action film Drug War, and made another $9 million. It's at $25 million and counting. Number eight is another inexpensive animated film for the kiddies. This is Chinese, and it's called Happy Little Submarine, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Boy, those kiddie animated films have really long, complicated titles, don't they? This one grossed $8.9 million on its opening weekend.
Yes, but that's a Chinese film, and I'm sure when you look at the Chinese title of it, it's two characters.
And number nine is Book Club, the film your mom went to see. That's just about to pass the $50 million mark. Skipping down to see where we've got any other noise, A Quiet Place passed $320 million worldwide. Life of the Party passed $50 million. Overboard, the remake of the Goldie Hawn flick, that passed the $75 million mark, so that's doing just great. And, here's a big shocker. Action Point opened up in North America. This is a Johnny Knoxville comedy. It grossed $2.3 million. And I don't believe I went on the record last week, but if I did, believe me, I would look like an idiot right now. So why don't you just tell me, Michael, you were wrong.
Michael, you were wrong. You said this movie was going to make $100 million in its first week.
Well, I absolutely thought it would open. Johnny Knoxville has all these Jackass movies, including Dirty Grandpa, have opened to $20 or $30 million every weekend. And the last two, including Dirty Grandpa, which was really a step forward because it wasn't just a stunt like Jackass, but it was an actual movie with a vague storyline, just like Action Point. But that's where he was in old man makeup. That, too, did really great. I mean, he's made more money than ever with his last two movies. And then they said, oh, this movie's not going to open at all. And I'm like, you're crazy. He's opened up every time. He's a proven guaranteed draw. Not only did I think he would open up, I thought he would do great. I thought he would do much better than they said, but it didn't. It like completely collapsed. It's a guy opening up a theme park where their whole gimmick is it's dangerous. Be careful, you might break your arm. It's an ideal setup for him. But you look at a bad grandpa, $160 million worldwide is what that cheap, low-budget movie made.
Yeah, I remember that's a lot it being of money. Quite the phenomenon at the time.
Jackass 3 made $170 million worldwide. I mean, he had jumped up to a whole new level. Jackass 2 made $85 million. Jackass made $80 million. So what you're looking at is 80, 85, 170, and 160 for what is essentially Johnny Knoxville and his pals being idiots. And then comes Action Point. Every one of those movies opened to $20 or $30 million on their opening weekend. This movie opened up at $2 million. What the hell happened? I mean, it's only been 4 years since Bad Grandpa. I have no idea.
Well, first of all, 5 years is kind of a lifetime when it comes to that. I mean, think about his fan base.
But Jackass 3 was 2010. Grandpa was 2013. I think actually doing them every year would tire it out more. I think you waited long enough
But think about it. 12, 13, 14-year-olds were going to see those movies, and now they're like in their 20s. So
I went to see them.
Okay,
I've seen them all. I'm not a particular.
My condolences. I don't know what to say.
You should, but I just as a commercial prospect, this movie, I felt like he really did a good job with Bad Grandpa, and here he is expanding the idea again. It's an actual story, but it totally works. And the trailer was funny, and I just thought, this just proves the old William Goldman adage: nobody knows nothing when it comes to Hollywood, especially me.
Well, you're only as good as your last movie, right? And so if that's the case, then MoviePass should be doing really well right about now.
Or Netflix should sign him up. A couple more new movies. 50 First Kisses is a Japanese remake of the Adam Sandler, Drew Barrymore romantic comedy. Speaking about people who have been picked up by Netflix, that opened up to $1.7 million. And then right here is a Russian film. A Rough Draft opened up. I guess it opened up on Wednesday. Its total is now $2.7 million. It's a fantasy about a video game designer who becomes guardian of a portal to multiverses. And it's based on a fantasy novel by Sergei Lukyanenko.
And why would you go see a movie called A Rough Draft? You already know it's not going to be great. It's a rough draft.
Do you remember when Stephen Hawking died?
I do.
Just a short time ago. And did we talk on the show about the fact that he had some papers coming out right when he died or were scheduled to be coming out?
No.
No. Okay. Yeah. So he's working furiously towards the end of his life, which is unusual to do any papers of any substance. You don't do groundbreaking work typically at that stage in your career. That's a young man's game. But he was doing significant, interesting work and publishing right up to the end. And there were a couple papers that they described saying these are coming out or about to come out or have come out, co-authored with other people, serious scholarly works. One of them was about multiverses.
What?
This is a serious thing that people tackle in the world of physics and, philosophy, if you want to call it that. And in this paper, he and a co-author were dealing with the problem that people said, if you've got multiverses and you've got all these different physics laws operating on these multiverses, how are we going to solve the problem of, this, that, and the other thing? And they said, what if all the multiverses just have the same laws of physics? Maybe those are a constant. Maybe the laws of physics that apply here apply through all the multiverse. In that case, they developed this idea and theory and certain suggestions. And because it's an actual scientific paper, there is a working hypothesis and there is something to look for. They say if there are multiverses and if they operate by the same laws of physics, look for this when we have the capability. You know how they say, all right, look for a quattrino when you get a chance. Look for this or that. Once you develop the ability to check for something, you can see if a paper was right. And sometimes it happens. You go, my God, they're right. There is such a thing as a quark. Now there is a thing out there where they can check. And if when they develop the ability, they can check and say, this doesn't mean there are multiverses, but it does get us one step closer to the idea that they actually exist.
Well, isn't that crazy? I like the parallel universe where I'm a superhero.
That's just crazy, though. There may actually be multiverses. Serious scientists have developed ideas of what to look for if there is a multiverse. Good heavens. And in another multiverse, Solo is a hit. But as you pointed out when we were talking before the show, this is Ron Howard's fifth domestic. Why domestic? Shouldn't you just say worldwide?
Yeah, pretty much. It's his fifth worldwide flop.
In a row, following In the Heart of the Sea, Rush, The Dilemma, and Inferno. Did they all lose money or were they just underperforming?
They were underperformed. I think like Rush may have made money. I think, you know, Inferno probably made money.
But they were nowhere near what people expected.
Right, exactly.
Or what they anticipated or what the franchise would suggest. Well, that's not good. So he's going to be looking for a hit.
Well, you know, MoviePass was looking for a hit when they went to Sundance this past year, and they may have found one because they picked up American Animals. They are co-distributing it with The Orchard, which is kind of an indie distributor. They distribute really small films that, they're usually festival favorites. And I don't know what they mean by co-distributing. I think ultimately they paid $3 million for it. And I don't mean MoviePass did. I think combined they paid $3 million. And maybe what The Orchard is doing is using MoviePass to fund the P&A, the prints and advertising.
Right. And how much, I mean, we've thought from the start, what a bad idea to do with your money when you're so new. And it's not like you have money to burn. Why is this the way you want to spend your money? But the movie had a pretty good opening, right? 35,000 per screen average. We'll see if it'll expand. It got mixed reviews. I had a friend who saw it and said it was pretty good. But.
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, certainly it's people either say, oh, this was like, you know, such a chore to sit through, or they're saying, you know what, it's really unique and interesting and, you know, might not be perfect, but it's worth seeing.
It doesn't mean it's a good idea for that's the way MoviePass should spend their money.
Correct, because you know what, even if this was a great movie and even if, you know, it makes, you know, $100 million, you really should not be taking wild swings like this because your next one that you spend $3 million on could lose an additional three as you try to distribute it and you now will have lost $6 million.
And that's money you need when people like me are going to the movies every single week.
Right, which is probably why they ask you to submit your movie tickets via, you know, photos. Whereas me, they're like, eh, whatever.
They insisted it was arbitrary, that it had nothing to do with how often you went to the movies. I had a friend who didn't understand it, and he kept taking a picture of his MoviePass card. He's like, well, how can I take a picture of the ticket until, you know, because it pops up right away as soon as you check in. So he's like, well, I don't have my ticket yet. How can I take a picture of it? So he was taking a picture of his MoviePass card. And they finally emailed him and said, take a picture of the ticket or we will kill your card.
Well, that's funny because I wondered, like, how do I know if I'm one of the people that has to send in the tickets? But I guess I have only used it once in the past 2 months. So.
Well, they email you saying this is you're going to have to do this. And when you check in to buy a ticket, it pops up and says, take a picture of your ticket.
Wow. Well, you know, I am looking forward to seeing American Animals. But all this whole take a picture of your ticket and all that is like a whole rigmarole that seems a little complicated.
It's no big deal. It's perfectly easy to deal with. You know, it's just an innovation, and I don't know what it helps them particularly. But, you know, they're experimenting, they're trying things, and that's what's happening in China.
Yes, that's right. So you have a number of things going on in China. Certainly, we talked last week about this smart cinema where you get to, like, watch, you know, first-run movies on your smartphone. And
that's right. iQIYI, or however you say this name, they're trying to do it as well. Their product is called Yuki, and it's the same idea where you're not at the theater, but you can get an on-demand look at a new movie. I don't know if it's on your phone or laptop or what. The legality of both of them is unclear, but they're looking at a big country with a billion people. While there are a ton of screens, there's still lots of areas that are underserved, and I think they're trying to say, you know, we want to, it's like, you know, movie opens up at IFC or Angelica. It may also be available on demand even before the movie opens. So the idea is for movies, I think, that are not as the biggest films, though I'm sure they'd like to have Solo or whatever available. But that's the idea.
And who knows? Disney might just give it to them.
That's right. And it's there's even a group, the Nationwide Alliance of Art House Cinemas. That's kind of cool to see in China. 600 screens devoted to art house and international fest winners. And here's the interesting thing. They're not bound by the quota system.
Right. So they're basically saying, look, we know you're not going to be taking money away from our homegrown domestic content. Okay. There's only 600 screens. They're probably not, seated, you know, with thousands of seats. So you know what? The movies that go there, we get
whatever.
Some
we
of them,
care.
Yeah, they'll be in Spanish, they'll be in French, they'll be in German, they'll be in Korean, who knows, but we're not going to count that against the 34 that we're allowing in that are probably all from Hollywood and big players.
So we've got the a 600 screen chain. Is that that's got to be as many, if not more, official art?
It's not a chain.
No.
Yeah,
it's an alliance. But there aren't 600 screens devoted to art house cinemas in America, are there?
Oh yeah, I would imagine there are. You know what? I don't know, but I will try and find that. That's a good question. But I do know that the independent, there was some independent group that formed recently.
But that would be any independent theater chain. It's not, they might be showing, Avengers.
Correct.
It doesn't mean they're right in an art house screen. And of course, you say that's a good question, but you never come back to us with the answer.
It's funny. I was waiting for you to mention that. I wondered if anybody would ever call me out on that. And I'm glad that it was you.
Well, it's a distinction here because we have art house chains like IFC and Angelica, but basically every multiplex in the country shows art house films now. They're showing documentaries like RBG. They're showing Bollywood cinema. They're showing foreign language titles. So I think the blurring of art house and multiplex is established now. But it would be interesting to know how many theaters say we are an art house cinema only. We're not going to show Avengers. We're just showing, the cool stuff. So it'd be a fun thing to know. And those people are experimenting with on-demand a la IFC and Sundance. So a lot of things going on in China. They're trying to figure it out. It's a big growing market, the number one in the world. And just like here in North America, they're going to try everything to make as much money as possible.
Well, and then you have ABC, which is actually, walking away from money.
That's right. ABC has canceled the number one TV show in the country. I thought it was just the number one sitcom, but in fact, Roseanne, over its entire run of 9 episodes in the new season, averaged 19 million viewers in Live Plus 3. They averaged 22 million viewers in Live Plus 7. By either standard, it was the biggest show in the country with more viewers than This Is Us or the sitcom Big Bang Theory. Maybe Game of Thrones is bigger, but it wasn't airing this season. But it is the number one show in the country, and ABC canceled it. That has never happened before in the history of television.
You know what Roseanne asked over the weekend?
No, what?
So I shouldn't count myself in for the Emmys?
Well, that's actually funny. Well, good for her. I think everybody knows this story. I think to me, what was most interesting was how...
We should just kind of say, she said some racist things on Twitter and ABC and its parent company, Disney, decided to cancel the show because of it.
She said her latest racist comment. And
correct.
That's a good point to make for people who pointed out you should not have been in business with her in the first place. Variety had an opinion piece tearing her apart along with ABC, listing all of her offensive, outrageous comments that she has made over the years. I mean, that week alone when she did this, she claimed Chelsea Clinton was married to the son of George Soros. And when people said, well, no, she's not, Roseanne said, well, whatever, George Soros, who, by the way, fled, fascism. She said he was a Nazi sympathizer who sent Jewish people to die.
Yeah, if there's anybody who
that's
isn't.
That's the day or two before that she said this unbelievably offensive comment. And she's made other references to black people as, comparing them to apes in the past. So this is not a one-off, oh, I made a mistake, I Twittered while on Ambien. This is a history of, racist, hateful commentary that she has indulged in for years. And people said, you shouldn't have been in bed with her in the first place.
Well, it's kind of funny that you say in bed, because she did actually fault the fact that she was tweeting while on the sleep aid Ambien at 2 o'clock in the morning, to which our, friend and former co-host Karen Woodward would say, no celebrity should be tweeting for themselves.
Right, exactly. Yeah, if you're thinking of commenting on it, don't. That's why we say that. You shouldn't be on Twitter, period. And, Tom Arnold said the same thing. He talked a little bit about what was going on behind the scenes. He's not friends with her as such anymore, but he still reaches out to her and other people around her, family and friends. And he was like, you got to take the phone away from her. And she refused. She wouldn't let them take her phone away. And he drafted a statement for her to say she'd step away from the phone. He said she was going to make life miserable for everyone anyway if season 2 happened. He asked Rosie O'Donnell to call her and show a little public support as a human being, not to endorse what she said, of course. But, there was a lot going on behind the scenes because this was a big money maker. A lot of people are involved. A lot of people are out of work. But what astonished me, even in this day and age where we're used to it, was how fast it happened. This was the latest tweet. It wasn't like it came out of nowhere, but she tweeted an unbelievably racist comment. There was a huge outcry. Wanda Sykes quit the show as a writer. Sarah Gilbert, who's the star and made the show happen as a producer, she fumed publicly and said how disappointed she was and it didn't represent the show or everybody else working on it. Roseanne apologized, said she was going to delete her account. ABC canceled the show. We got think pieces on the whole affair and people discussed, hey, why not bring back the show without her?
Yeah.
All in one, like 36 hours that happened.
That was pretty remarkable, actually. And you know, that was the story, right? That it didn't take days. It took hours.
Exactly. And what's interesting is...
And we should point out, by the way, for those who don't know outside the country, Tom Arnold is a comedian who used to be married to Roseanne Barr and in fact was on the first iteration of Roseanne.
I would like to say that of the many things you have explained over the years, David Letterman, that is a perfectly reasonable explanation. I pat you on the back for that one, Dad. You should explain who Tom Arnold is. That makes sense. But our old friend Mark Berman, he's a TV expert. He's at programminginsider.com. He was the first person that I saw who said, why cancel it? Just call it the Connor family. You've got John Goodman, Sarah Gilbert, Laurie Metcalf. Heck, you've got a grandchild whose grandmother we have not met yet, a child of mixed race. Why not have Wanda Sykes back on the show as the grandmother? Wouldn't that be a big hilarious F you? You know, like not only did Roseanne lose the part, but kind of Wanda Sykes steps in as this sort of, you know, caustic central figure in the show. You know, it's happened before. Two and a Half Men ran for 4 years without Charlie Sheen. The TV show Valerie, built around Valerie Harper, ran for 4 years without her. That was twice as long as it ran with her. You know, she was on the show for 2 years. It ran for 6 years total. That was the Hogan family with Jason Bateman. It, you know, people try it all the time. And in this case, ABC has to pay everyone at least a chunk of change. By everyone, I mean the stars, not the writers and the crew. But the stars have, you know, they got to get paid.
Yeah.
They're going to get paid something.
Just to, you know, a couple points here. One, you know, a lot of people said, I can't believe the ABC is canceling their, you know, their big breadwinner here. You know, ABC is owned by Disney, a $54 billion company. Or I should say they made like $52 or $54 billion in revenue last year and $9 billion in profit. And according to several sources here, it looks like Roseanne over its 9-episode run made $45 billion in revenue.
Million.
Sorry, did I say billion? $45 million dollars in revenue. And so that's like a small drop in the bucket revenue wise. It's like 0.1% of the profit for Disney. So this is not it's not great for ABC, but it's not like they're taking a huge financial risk here.
Well, I think that's a little misleading. It may have grossed $45 million in revenue for those 9 episodes, but there were going to be 13 episodes for the next run. It was anchoring an evening, which lets them introduce other shows with the most popular show in the country as a lead-in, which helps get those shows sampled and seen and maybe launch their next big hit that can run 5 or 10 years. And if you look at Roseanne over the years, this is an extremely valuable property. You're squeezing out more money out of it, but this show has certainly probably grossed at least $500 million in its lifetime. So this is a big, big property that is worth a lot of money. And if you can launch just one show off of it, slipstream behind it and get that show sampled and suddenly you got a hit that may not have happened otherwise, you can't put a dollar figure on that. But I think you're right. ABC did not make a moral stance here and say, we are offended and we are going to take a bullet and lose money because we can't. This is a business decision. Absolutely. They looked at the numbers, the outcry. It was serious. They do not need that damage to their brand and whatever money they would have made off Roseanne. And they now are looking at a fall schedule where they don't have an anchor show on Tuesday night. They don't have the number one show in the country. That hurts in a lot of different ways. And so it is a hit, but overall, big picture, not worth it.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I think the decision making was. And keep in mind, Disney is trying to go after Fox. They're trying to buy Fox, right? And so, you know what? You don't really need that kind of headache when you're trying to do something that is questionably, you know, the government might get involved in.
I don't know. I think in this case, it might be a plus with the Trump administration to keep Roseanne on the air. So they might hurt themselves by canceling it.
Yeah, but remember, they're also would have to take over Sky in the EU. And there was that whole issue with, is Fox...
But there's a lot of think pieces out there. I have to give props to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Man, I want to interview this guy. He is so interesting. He writes pieces regularly for The Hollywood Reporter. He waited on this show. And as always, he does so very thoughtfully and interestingly, with not trying to be contrary and find a new perspective, but just, you know, takes a moment and thinks about it. One thing he said blew my mind away. He said, "Should the show have been canceled? I don't know yet, because I usually need some time to process information and think through all the consequences." That alone is an amazing statement to make. What? You want to take more than 5 seconds to think about an issue before weighing in? That goes against my very principle. But I mean, that's awesome. He said, "My immediate reaction, like every person of color, is to punish her by taking away her show. Disney and ABC decided within hours of the tweet to cut off the rotting appendage before it infected the rest of the body. On the other hand, the TV show Roseanne is a very good show. Ironically, it's one of the most liberal shows on TV, which I agree with a clear agenda of tolerance and compassion. To punish Roseanne, we've removed the louder, smarter, more influential voice of the show itself. Roseanne's tweets may give solace to other racists, but they have no real impact in changing minds. The show, which reaches millions, can affect people by showing tolerance and compassion on a weekly basis." You know, and he makes a great point, which is one more reason beyond money why they might want to try and salvage what they had.
You know, what's interesting is you mentioned that they owe money to, you know, ABC will pay off the talent. And that is true because they have contracts. But then you have all of these writers, right, which, okay, some of them may still get paid, but they all, whether it's the writers or the below-the-line crews and the production staff, they all turn down potential other work on other series after pilot season to stay with this show. And they're now out of work for the entire year. Well, for a period of time, if not the entire year.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, it hurts them a lot. Roseanne recognizes that and has apologized for that in certain ways. But that, yeah, it really has a big repercussion on a lot of people. You know, every TV show ends, but it's really hard when you're on a show, you commit to it, you know you're going to be around for a little while, and then suddenly it gets yanked out from under you. People got bills to pay. You know, very few people working in TV or film are millionaires and raking in tens of, you know, that's all you think about is Tom Cruise. But the vast majority of them have rent and insurance and kids in school, and this hurts.
Yeah, and, you know, Samantha Bee, who is a comedian and hosts kind of a public, well, not a public, but she's on TBS, and she does this, it's like
she's
the Daily Show.
She's got a political comedy show. Yeah.
And everybody was after her because she called Ivanka Trump the C word. Okay, well, you know what? I don't liken the two at all.
Liken the two of what? What to what?
I don't liken the two issues. They say, well, Samantha Bee should be fired because she used a derogatory word.
It got nothing to do with each other.
Exactly.
She's talking about a person in power, and Roseanne is making fun of people because of their race. You know, that's like saying there's no difference between Dr. King and the KKK. Samantha Bee is, you know, challenging people in power. Ivanka Trump is an advisor to the president, you know. She used a vulgar term to describe her, but she's a public figure, and she's not calling her, she's not using racist terminology to denigrate all people of that race or gender. She's just saying, you're a horrible person. I don't think she should have done it. But it's, you know, basically I would say to Samantha Bee, you know what? They can always yell louder.
Right.
So that's just not the way to go. Try to be funny. Focus on being funny. When I watch a show, I actually don't enjoy that parts where she gets really angry and yells and just, you know, says how stupid and awful they are. It's not funny and it's not interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, crass language always has a way of coming back to bite you when you're directing it at someone. And
someone who thrives on it. It's their superpower. It's, you know, they love it when you use crass language and get, you know, obnoxious and vile and say things that other people who may have agreed with you go, oh, well, I don't want to hear that. I don't want to hear calling somebody, you know, the C word. That's not nice. So then they get to waste days talking about that. In the Atlantic Monthly, David Frum had a piece, and he said, the way to counter Trump is with decency, you know?
Yeah.
And he talked about focus on the facts. Well, that's not what Samantha Bee does. She counters with comedy, but calling someone the C word isn't particularly funny. It's just crass.
Well, you know, I think you are making my point for me, so I appreciate that.
Well, there you go. It must be time for Book Filter. If you're wondering why I haven't had picks for the last few weeks, it's because I'm not a coder.
What?
I don't code, and my website is screwed up. There's nothing I can do about it as I try and get people in Mumbai to fix my website for me. I just can't fix it, so I don't have a lot of good information flowing in. The data is screwed up.
Oh, it's still there. All the feeds from all the different publishers.
Right, right. But it's my website and how we process it that's the problem, not the feeds from the publishers. So yeah, it's a big pain in the neck. There's still, if you go there every week, you'll find cool books. There's stuff from, a lot of publishers and all the books I've read, but it's just a headache right now. And I feel like it doesn't really represent as good as it should all the books coming out every week. So it's a big pain in the neck. And so that's why I don't have picks, but we do have information about book sales.
So what's going on with book sales? Because I know I'm reading more.
Well, there you go. You must be Canadian.
Not really. No, I'm trying to get through Lincoln and the Bardo. So I'm reading more, but of one book.
So you're not Canadian?
No, I'm not Canadian.
Okay, I'm not sure what Lincoln and the Bardo has to do with being Canadian.
Well, why don't you tell me about what the Canadians are doing? Get it? Because I'm Canadian. It's a Canadian joke. It's a Canadian
joke.
Well,
they're I'm not sure if it's their biggest chain. I think maybe it is, but Indigo is the signature chain in Canada. They are known for their innovation and all the different things they try, and they've had a good year. The fiscal year of 2018, sales went up, revenue went up. Same store sales went up more than 6%. Revenue went up to almost 6% over the previous year. It hit $780 million at Indigo. The problem is that their double-digit growth was in quote-unquote general merchandise. You know, Indigo is one of those places that has, you know, stationery and games and lots of stuff in the lifestyle for people who also like to read. Actual book sales at Indigo, they declined slightly. So they have more sales, they're just not selling more books.
Well, North America, that's not good.
That's not great. Having a sales decline is not great. North America, the news is a little better. The American Association of Publishers, and of course, this will not include Amazon. I don't believe they even report to them in their sales. But they have more than 1,000 different publishers offering up info. And the first quarter of 2018, sales are up. Just like at Indigo, sales were up 6% over the same quarter in 2017. Now, Indigo was the entire fiscal year. This is just talking about the first quarter of 2018. Sales are up. Digital audio is up 32%. Hardcover is up 11%. Thank you, Fire and Fury. That's what bookstores are saying. Ebook sales are down 3%. However, as we said at the top of the show, ebook sales grew in March over the previous year. That's the first time in a while there's even been a month where ebook sales went up over the same month or quarter 1 year prior. So perhaps ebook has turned a little bit of a corner and they've reached a basement level and are starting to grow again. But if you look at the different formats, hardcover is about 30% of the market, paperback is about 32%, ebook is 22%, and digital audio, which is growing by leaps and bounds, that's about 8%. So there's a lot of sales here, and these sales figures do include educational sales. But overall, basically, a lot of publishers, 1,000 of them, say sales are turning up. And so that's a good sign. Now, you have to keep in mind, this does not include Amazon. They are the number one bookstore in the country. They are the number one self-publisher in the country. So this does not include any of the figures for those hundreds of thousands of books that are self-published. That's a big market. There's lots of books that get sold only on Amazon. That's where most ebook sales happen. So we're really getting a sort of distorted picture on ebook sales and sales overall. But it's good news. You know, when sales go up 6%, that's a big deal.
You said big and deal together, so it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, is YouTube stressful for its stars? It's stressful, I don't know, for its viewers, that's for sure. A wave of YouTube celebs have gone public detailing the stress and depression they face while trying to stay on the hamster treadmill of round-the-clock updates that is life in social media and YouTube. Every time a performer takes a break, hardcore fans are supportive, but more casual fans are dismissive about the so-called hardships of creating dumb comedy videos or, you know, cat videos or whatever. Try a real job, they say. Nevertheless, people with millions of followers like Bobby Burns, L. Mills, and Ruben Gunderson, who has some 30 million followers and is one of the most popular YouTubers in the world, they all show themselves venting or confessing to health issues. Is this a real problem or just an indication that their fame is ephemeral and has more to do with momentum than any inherent talent? Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. There's so many interesting elements to this. Welcome to the gig economy. That's the first thing. It's like you're your own boss. You set your own hours. Your own hours just happen to be 20 hours a day.
Yes. And by the way, they're not the first people to complain about this. If you recall, bloggers, back when blogging took off, 2007 through 2009, 10, 11, bloggers, especially tech bloggers, began to realize, oh my God, I am working nonstop. If a news story breaks and I'm not there to comment about it and write about it within the first hour, I lose thousands of page views, which means I lose advertising. And all of a sudden, Ohm Malik had a heart attack. And, you know, he was the editor of GigaOhm. And then Michael Arrington also started to suffer from health issues, and he started to step away. And so this is not something that's new.
No, it's not new, but it's good of them to talk about it. I wouldn't say they're complaining so much as they are confessing or sharing. That's the way they want it to be seen. And I think it's a combination of a lot of things, the nature of the job they're doing, the fact that you are in a gig economy, and if you don't stay on top of it, someone else is going to claw their way past you and you'll never regain your spot. That's true. It's a little bit of, being a star. You think, oh my God, if I'm on YouTube and I can make a living, even a good living, off of millions of people watching my videos and laughing and saying how cool I am, that's going to be awesome. I'll be happy forever. And every celebrity will tell you, you know what? You achieve fame and success. It doesn't mean your life becomes easy or happy all the time. And finally, I think it's just a general trend towards people being more honest about depression. And that's a great thing because people have dealt with depression in every job, and you've got to be honest and straightforward about it. It's a health issue just like any other. And, you know, if you have real fans, they will support you. So be honest, do what you need to do for your health, and your fans will stand by you.
On a semi-related note, there was a great article in the Sunday Review section or the opinion section in the New York Times about somebody of Pakistani descent in England who, as they were growing up, wanted to, you know, do YouTube videos and become a YouTuber. And and they cajoled their mother into participating in these videos. And after, about a year, all of a sudden they're getting a phone call from some producers of a television show in India, and they want to talk to somebody about casting the mother in a new show. And the mother went on to be a huge star in India.
Ouch.
Now you know what the father is saying to their son? Hey, what about me? How come you haven't made me a star? Okay, now the Paramount Network just canceled the TV spinoff of Heathers before the show even began. I don't know why they're canceling any show, but you might be asking why. Too many damn school shootings made it impossible for them to find a safe week or two when they could show the pilot, air the pilot. The original film was a black satire that included shootings and blowing up the entire school at the finale. Back in 1988, that was crazy talk, over-the-top lunacy that no one took seriously for a minute as anything other than exaggerated spin on real life. Well, not anymore. The show was set for a March debut, but then the Parkland, Florida shootings happened. They moved the debut to July, but now the Santa Fe, Texas shootings have happened and made that too close for comfort. So Paramount just killed it. Real life has too many school shootings for them to find a safe harbor for when they can air their latest show. Big deal or big whoop?
It would be funny if it wasn't so sad.
That's very true.
It's unreal, how that film became like a blueprint instead of just an absurd satire. And now they can't even air the damn thing because there's so many shootings. The problem is not that the show deals with shootings or deals with it in a satirical way. The problem is that there are too many damn shootings. Good Lord.
Yeah. And I guess the question is, what came first, the blueprint or
Well, it's not a blueprint. Nobody needed that to know to kill people. It's just we're in a different world now. I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying the problem is that there's too many damn shootings. You should be able to air this show. And the fact that you can't is the problem, not the show or its content.
Concert tours play the long game. Much like worldwide box office, different tours aren't really competing with each other. Ranked number 4 on the weekly box office chart for tours and do it every week for a year, you'll make a ton of money. Hit number 1 for 1 week and then find out you've got no fans outside your hometown and it's a different story. Still, pay attention and you can learn a lot. Taylor Swift just launched her world tour, and after just 5 cities, she grossed $54 million and ranks at number 1. Based on that launch, her tour could gross $400 million when all is said and done. Kenny Chesney is at number two with $11 million. And then there's a big drop to Imagine Dragons with $2.5 million at number three. And James Taylor at number four with $1.4 million. Also in the top 10, Anita Baker, Chicago, Sam Smith, and Five Finger Death Punch with Shinedown in good old Birmingham, Alabama. Big dealer, big whoop.
Well, I'm heading to Birmingham, Alabama in a week or two to see my mom before she heads to Europe. That's why I mentioned that. It's a big deal. It's a launch to a really big tour that's going to make a lot of money. Touring is interesting. That's where stars make their money in the music world now. That's really a far more dependable than your video. It grosses a billion views and you're like, hey, I got 50 bucks. So they need that. And Taylor Swift, clearly one of the biggest stars today commercially. But she started out when she was really young, just like Shawn Mendes, who has just topped the Billboard album chart for the third time. His third album is out. It's number one. I really like the Blood song, but other than that, I think it's a little weak, but that song is a really good single. He's 19 years old, and he has had three number one albums. Only Justin Bieber and Miley Cyrus have done that when they were younger.
Well, his last song left me in stitches. Get it? Because he wrote Stitches.
I got it.
Okay. Speaking of tours, you know who I saw? We talked about this, actually. In a past episode, I can't tell you the name of the number of the episode, but we talked about, you know, Paul Simon going on his, you know, last tour, his farewell tour. And I went to see him at the Hollywood Bowl, at last minute tickets, somebody couldn't use. And I have to say it was really good. I wasn't expecting much, but I kind of forgot what a great songwriter he is.
Yeah, he's one of the greatest of all time. I've seen some of my favorite shows of all time have been Paul Simon and Simon and Garfunkel. His voice I'm worried about, but his voice held up enough. It was still good.
Yes. I mean, you're right. There are some songs that, you know, he sings the same set list every night. Okay. And he has to sing some songs, you know, because they're hit songs. But for the most part, you realize he's not singing certain songs that where the voice goes up into higher registers. But his voice did hold up toward the end of the show. You could see it flagging a bit. That could have just been the night. It was an outside.
No. His voice is, you know, it's a little ragged now. It just doesn't have what it used to have. Same thing with James Taylor. But he has one of the great live bands around. I mean, I'm sure the music was tremendous.
It was like so tight. I mean, they were unbelievably tight. And of course, he actually introduces them and he starts talking about how they've been with him for years.
Oh, 20, yeah, since Graceland, he's slowly built up a core of artists that have been with him for, you know, a long, long time. Yeah, they're a great live act. I've seen him tremendous shows at the Beacon, in the Central Park, in Atlanta, Simon and Garfunkel at Madison Square Garden. So I felt like, you know what, I've seen him in the best possible way. I didn't want to go see him one more time and have it, you know, when it wasn't as perhaps peak, but I'm glad to hear it was a good show.
You know what? If I could see him at the Beacon, that would be great. Yeah. Because that would be kind of a, you know, I saw him at the Hollywood Bowl. See, it's 20,000 people. I would love to see, and even though I had good seats, I would love to see him, in a intimate setting like the Beacon Theater.
Of course.
Okay, now Fox, we've talked about, you know, how they're for sale, right? Or they're trying to sell themselves. They are sending this decision to their shareholders. And you might be saying, what decision? Well, they've got a stock offer from Disney of about $52 billion for a big chunk of their company. You should be thinking right now, decision over, we'll take it.
Yeah.
And then they've got an all-cash offer from Comcast that's about $10 billion larger. Which should they consider? Which is most likely to go through government regulatory approval? And do they even care what's best for the companies they are selling off? Stockholders will weigh in on July 10th. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, such a tough decision. Cake or death?
Cake?
Death. I'll take... No, death. It's like, well, all right, I'll take the $62 billion offer, Jack. You know, it's like, well, okay. But I don't know if there's some... you say, however, will it go through? So are they going to present it to their shareholders and saying, this is a bigger offer, but we think it's less likely to go through, and that might queer the other deal. In that case, maybe the safer, smarter thing is that one. Be interested to see how they present it to their shareholders and what they decide. So it's a big deal because no matter what happens, this is going to change the landscape of the entertainment business.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it. You've got a $10 billion additional all cash offer coming from Comcast. The problem is it probably won't get through regulatory approval because I think you know, the Justice Department is already kind of a little disappointed. They let the Comcast NBC Universal thing go through. That's number one. Number two, it would mean Comcast has, you know, they'd have to take on all of that debt to buy Fox, and they'd have $140 billion in debt. So how healthy is that company? So if you're Fox,
but they don't care. They don't care, right? If you're selling it off, you don't care how healthy they're going to be as long as you get your money.
Correct.
Yeah. All right.
Well, last week we talked about Sony almost doubling its holdings in music publishing with one big deal. Turns out Apple wants a piece of the pie as well, but they're starting from scratch. Rolling Stone reports Apple is launching its own music publishing division and hiring the execs to make it happen. This could make it easier for Apple to strike licensing deals for artists' music, or could start signing and developing songwriters directly. Certainly, many analysts think it makes sense for Spotify or Apple to launch an in-house label, the same way, say, Amazon publishes books and offers one-stop shopping for self-publishing authors. So is this a big deal or a big whoop, or are we just going to see a whole bunch of self-published albums that nobody wanted to hear?
I think it's a big deal. I think it shows a convergence of the industry. You know, streaming is still a separate business from record labels and music publishing, but not for long.
Yes, it's going to change. Dead Man Walking. That's true for people on death row. It's doubly true for the zombies on the smash hit AMC show The Walking Dead. And now it's triply true for that show's star Andrew Lincoln. He's calling it quits after 9 seasons, with the upcoming season set to be his last. With his character and his sons both written out of the show, but still very much the center of the ongoing comic book series, The Walking Dead is clearly charting a course very different from its source material. AMC's first step? Signing up actor Norman Reedus as Daryl to be the new heart of the show for a cool $20 million. Hey, AMC, I'll gladly be the heart of the show for $15 million. You just save yourself $5 million. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal. I'm not sure. I mean, Norman Reedus is, you know, right up there in terms of the, you know, the characters in the show, but I don't know. I would have liked Michonne. I'd rather have her be the heart of the show, do something different. But, you know, that's a big property. They want to play it safe. This is kind of fascinating, though. If you look at Andrew Lincoln's career and what he's done since he broke through here and what people are saying, they're like, you know what? He has no interest in exploiting or trying to launch a million other things on top of his success in the show. He's only 44 years old, but you get the sense he's like, you know what? I grabbed the brass ring. I'm really happy and I'm done. I mean, yeah. He has not made a single film since this show broke in 2010. Not one. You know, he was in lots of movies before that, never wildly successful, but he had 2 movies out in 2010, a number of films before that. He's had TV shows where he's gotten close, like This Life ran for a couple years in the 90s. Teachers, that ran for 20 episodes in 2001 to 2003. Nothing within 1,000 miles of this. And you feel like he just said, you know what, this is it. This was my big role, and I'm happy with that. He you know, he's done some theater work. Again, nothing since this show happened. It's all consuming, of course, but you also have the sense from what people say that he's not interested in saying, all right, now I've done the show, now I'm going to, you know, get all these other opportunities. You feel like he just wants a big break after working really, really hard for 9 years.
Speaking of working hard for 9 years, Neil Portnow, the beleaguered head of the Recording Academy that oversees the Grammys, announced he would step down from his position when his contract runs out in July of 2019. This allows for the Academy to search for a new head and plan a smooth transition. It also allows them to acknowledge that Portnow's reign needed to end after a series of bad decisions and crisis, including his tone-deaf comments on women and claims of misusing funds intended for the charity Music Cares to cover the costs of holding the Grammys in New York City this past year. Is this enough to end the complaints about the Academy, or is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I'm going to say the favorite headline of this story was Neil Portnow told women to step up and now he's stepping down. So that was, everybody loved that headline. That was the headline. His big gaffe on women in the music industry where he said, hey, you guys got to step it up. They're like, excuse me?
Yeah.
I think what's interesting here is not the fact that he's stepping down, but that they're hoping they can wait a year to do it. We'll have to see if people will be placated and say, okay, at least we know he's out the door, or whether they're going to say, no, another year is too long. Change needs to happen now. That's the only question.
But the reality is this. You need to find somebody else to lead it. You may as well have some continuity there. He's already said he's leaving. At least take some time, find the right person, and then have a transition.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what they hope people say, as opposed to he's unacceptable and we don't want him around any longer. And why wait a year to do it?
Yeah, I mean, look, he said some tone deaf stuff, as we said. He didn't kill someone. He didn't, you know, tweet something racist.
But he's arguably done a very poor job. Now there's a scandal in the last 5 years. He's done a terrible, you know, he lost them tons of money bringing the Grammys to New York. There's been complaints about, you know, misusing funds for a charity to cover those losses.
The charity forcing, that he himself started, but go ahead.
Well, that I don't care if you that your charities, you don't get to misuse a charity just because you started it.
I'm just saying that, you know, he did do some good things for the Academy. It's
well,
just
he's
that
been there 20, 25 years. Maybe he's been there too long.
That's definitely always an issue, I think, no matter, you know, who it is
always,
and what business it is.
You always take the white male's point of view.
No, I think, look, you know, I find it interesting. Ron Meyer, when I was at CAA and he left to run
Universal,
that's right. Yeah, he came back and he gave these like master classes, these talks, you know, a couple of times. And one of the things he said was that Sid Sheinberg and Lou Wasserman, they had been in charge. Lou Wasserman had been there forever, but Sid Sheinberg had been there for, you know, 25 years. And he said, look, 25 years is too long for any one person to run a company because, you know, just it's just bad. It's bad for business. Well, now he's been there 25 years. And as much as he keeps saying he wants to leave, he never does. So
he's been the head for 18 years. Yeah.
1995 is when he,
but he's been the head since 2002.
Okay. So yeah, as the chairman. Okay. Yeah. Another day, another lawsuit. This one is interesting because of why the Hollywood Reporter says it didn't cover the story earlier. Comedian Jerry Seinfeld is being sued over the creation of the online series Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. Director Christian Charles says he conceived of the show, shot the pilot, and cajoled Seinfeld every step of the way, even though the actor was not really all that into it. Charles has a long-time association with Seinfeld, having directed the documentary film Comedian. Charles is also credited with directing Episode 7 in the first season of Comedians in Cars. Charles also lists working on more than a dozen Super Bowl commercials and directed several of the Seinfeld ads for American Express. So why did the Hollywood Reporter not cover this story when Charles first filed suit in court? Because Charles was representing himself is the answer. They have a policy that such lawsuits are almost always frivolous and never go anywhere. When you represent yourself, you don't have to meet certain standards that even a hack lawyer would have to meet in order to bring it before a court. Now that Charles has a lawyer and the amended lawsuit has been filed, they decided it is newsworthy. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop in terms of the lawsuit. I don't know what sort of claim he has. It seems to be more than the usual claim. They certainly were involved with each other for a number of years. But I did think it was really interesting about why they didn't cover it beforehand and maybe others did. And they said, yeah, you know what? When you file a lawsuit yourself, there's too many of those to take seriously. Unless you've got a lawyer, we're not going to take it seriously either. So I thought that was a good thing to know.
3 weeks after it launched a hate conduct policy, Spotify has backed off. The idea was to simply...
That's right. They now love hate.
Yeah, exactly.
Bring on the hate.
They hated their own hate policy. The idea was to simply stop promoting artists identified as the sort Spotify didn't want to be associated with. Those artists might appear on Spotify, but the company would simply choose not to include them on Spotify playlists or recommend them as acts to check out. Spotify did consult with advocacy groups like GLAAD and the ADL, but when the policy was announced, the first three acts mentioned were people of color not convicted of any crimes. It wasn't endorsed by everyone at Spotify, some of whom knew nothing about it, and it raised a lot more questions than it answered. Our bad, they said, dropping the idea, at least for the moment, or at least not making a big deal of it. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. It was a reasonable idea. Hey, let's not really promote artists that we don't want to be associated. You know, why tout people that aren't good for our brand? They did it in a very poor way. There's no reason why they shouldn't do it down the road, casually or in some way. They just maybe don't necessarily have to wave a flag about it and shout it from the rooftops.
Yeah, but I don't know why they just said, yeah, you know, we're not going to, you know. Just not going to promote our, you know, I guess it was R. Kelly was one of them.
And if someone says, hey, how come R. Kelly isn't on your playlist? You know, you don't have to really answer that. You're like, well, you know, there's lots of things go into playlists, you know. You know, they made it an issue. They wanted it to be a plus for them, but they launched it in a poorly ill-thought-out way. They didn't have everybody on board. That was a big problem. You know, you're going to launch something in your company. Make sure everybody's on board. Your top execs, the people who work with the record labels, make sure they know what it is, have given their input, and can support it.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and brings us along to Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, we're talking about the Tony Awards, which happen on Sunday. And Michael, at
Wait, I'm getting a vision. I know who's going to win the Tony Awards.
Well, yeah, you know, that's really how they will affect our listeners, because those listeners that aren't in New York, the winners of the Tony Awards, maybe not the revival, you're going to be seeing some of these shows, come to your town probably in the next 2 to 3 years. So, Michael,
I would say, in fact, every show that performs on the Tonys, certainly the musicals, you're lucky to have touring around the country. You know, they're all going to be out there. So even it's not just the winners; they're all going to be out there.
Yes, that is true. So yeah. Who will be winning this year's Tony Awards?
Well, there's just not a lot of suspense this year in the big categories. The best new play is Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. That's going to win. It's certainly the best production, really well done. I haven't seen every show, so I'm just talking about the reputation. For me, the best play I saw was the UK import, The Children. I read Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. I'd love to see it, but even if I saw it, and even if it was a great production, I wouldn't say it was the best new play of the year, but it's going to win. Best new musical, The Band's Visit, based on a terrific international film. That is the best musical of the year. It was amazing, and it's not even a close call there. Nobody else, not Mean Girls, not Frozen, not SpongeBob, nobody else is within a mile of The Band's Visit in quality or critical support.
So let me get this straight. Best new musical, those nominated, are all based on movies.
There might be an original one in there, but the ones I named are all based on movies. Yes. Or TV shows.
Yeah. Okay.
And the best new play is based on a movie, which is based on a book. Best play revival is the revival of Angels in America. There is a possibility Three Tall Women could spoil, but I would place money on all of these picks. Certainly The Band's Visit. I doubt you could make a penny. You'd have to gamble $1,000 to make $100, I think, in order to, make any money on betting on what the best musical winner will be. Best music revival? Maybe there's a little bit of question there. It's almost certainly going to be My Fair Lady. Maybe Once on This Island could spoil, but I doubt it. It's going to be Harry Potter, The Band's Visit, Angels in America, and My Fair Lady.
Well, the good news for the Broadway Theater League, which hands these out, right, these awards, these Tonys, as they're called, is that, hey, you know what? Sales are up.
That's right. Sales are up. That's the message they want to get out. Attendance hit an all-time high this year on Broadway. 13,792,000 tickets were sold. But wait, this year was 53 weeks long for various accounting reasons. That happens every 7 years. But if you take out the extra week, attendance was still at a record high of 13.4 million people heading to a Broadway show. That's a modern all-time high. The grosses were also the best ever at $1.7 billion. And again, take out that extra week, you're still setting a record. So when you compare year to year, you're looking at a 52-week yardstick. Attendance was up 1.6% and grosses were up 14%. You go, huh, wow, 14%. That's a lot more than attendance was up. And when you look over the last 5, 10, 15 years, you can see the trend. Attendance has been growing from like 11.6 million all the way up to 13.8 million. And that's been about a 10% growth in the last 15 years. However, grosses, they have exploded. They have increased 125% in the last 15 years. So yes, audiences are still coming, but the cost of those tickets has exploded like you would not believe. Clearly, ticket prices are exploding far more than attendance. So they're not driving people away yet, but they are making it harder and harder for people to see the shows that are really the hottest ones in town.
Well, I feel like this all started with Book of Mormon, where the tickets were just ridiculously priced and people went, well, they're still paying for it, so let's increase the price.
Well, I remember when Cats went to $35 and people gasped, oh my God, but that's how much the demand was for that show. Every show has, pushed it. When you get a big blockbuster and they're setting new records, the desire, of course, is to raise the ticket price. And they always have the argument, oh, but scalpers charge more, so why shouldn't the money go to the show? Yes, but when you're turning Broadway into opera and it becomes so expensive to go see a show that most people literally can't even imagine doing it, and they say, well, I can't pay $300 for a good seat to see a show. You know, the Broadway League would say, well, but the average price was $109. Yeah, but if you want to see Hamilton, you want to see the hot shows, you're paying a lot more than that. So yeah, it gets really hard. And, you know, they have so few shows and so few houses that they're doing okay because they have a limited product and they have more demand than they need, than they want for that product. And especially when you're talking about a hit show in a small house, you got 1500 tickets to sell a day. More people went to see the flop solo, you know, than saw, a Broadway show last week. But compare it back to the 20s, you can see the difference. Back in the 1920s, 20 million people went to a Broadway show. That's in 1928. But there were 264 shows. In 2018, 90 years later, I guess, almost 14 million people went to a show, but there were only 67 of them. So, you know, there's far fewer shows, still a lot of people going to Broadway, but they're paying more money than ever. So the news about ticket prices is not good, no matter how you slice it. And the news about diversity, not so great either. When you look at the, who are these people? The Broadway by the Numbers people. They looked at the shows and they said, okay, there were about 230 lead roles on Broadway last season. 37% of them were women. And keep in mind, most of the people who go to see a Broadway show are women. So if you think women should be, my God, they're in the audience. Why shouldn't they be on the stage? Directors, 19% of them were women. Choreographers, 18% of them were women. Writers, where you think they might have an advantage, 16% were women. So the only area where women predominate on Broadway is in makeup and costumes. 67% of the people who do makeup are women, and a majority of the people who do costumes are women. That's it.
And stage managers.
Well, that's behind the stage. Yeah, that's the crew. I was talking about the creative talent and the people on stage. But in the crew, yes, hair and makeup people, most of them are women, 71%. Wardrobe, 65% of them are women. And stage managers, about half of them are women. So yeah, backstage, you'll find women. You'll find women in the audience. You just won't find them in charge.
Well, here's my question. You know, we talked about all of the numbers, right, for all of these shows that are, these 67 shows that are currently running or ran over the past year. But there are going to be some shows that are premiering and bowing, no pun intended.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the latest round of Invest or Not Invest.
That's
come
where
on,
I was
the
headed.
Game show. Let's pick it up, baby.
Okay, well, that's where I was headed because I searched so hard to find out when we did this last year so that I could kind of, you know, judge whether you did well.
Fair enough.
And I couldn't find it. I ran through all of our episodes and I couldn't find it.
We have too many shows, too many episodes.
Exactly. Maybe we should cut down to once per month and then I'd really know which one it was. But okay.
Well, you're trying.
low blow. Okay. So invest or not invest. This is where you decide whether you're going to, whether if you had the money, you would invest in a show or not invest in a show. So let's start with The Boys and the Band. This is a revival with a limited run. Would you invest or not invest?
Well, I would not invest in The Boys and the Band. Why? Because there's no upside. It's a limited run. Jim Parsons, Matt Bomer, Zachary Quinto, they're all stars. They're all out. It's exciting. It got good reviews, basically kind of mixed, but still positive. Audiences are jammed in there, but there's no upside. You know, you're not going to run for a long time. So the best you can do is not lose money. So I put that in there as sort of a placeholder for all the other shows with big stars and limited runs. There's no point in talking about them because unless you can replace that star or it's an open-ended run, there's really no point. You're not going to lose money on it, not on Boys in the Band, but I wouldn't invest in it because what are you going to do with it? You know, big deal. You get to go to the after party. Maybe it's worth it.
And believe it or not, there are some people that invest in shows just for that.
Absolutely.
Okay, what about Head Over Heels, which is debuting July 26th? It's a musical drawing on the songs of the Go-Go's.
That's right. You got good people here behind Head Over Heels. You got Michael Mayer directing. Jeff Witte of Avenue Q did the book. Would I invest or not invest? I would not invest.
I think that is a smart choice.
Well, it got mixed reviews out of town. It needs a lot of work. You know, if Jagged Little Pill, the Alanis Morissette musical, if I could invest in that, that opened out of town and got really good reviews. That needs work too, but they're a hell of a lot closer. That show I would buy into. The Go-Go's one, I'd like to be at that after party too, but I'm not going to invest.
Yeah, I know people who saw this in San Francisco and said, eh, yeah, didn't really work. Okay, what about getting... What is the deal with the bands? Okay, you got Head Over Heels, Boys in the Band, Getting the Band Back Together, which will premiere August 13th. It's a musical about a middle-aged guy who gets the band back together. He plans to recapture his high school glory, win a local battle of the bands, and use the prize money to keep his home.
All right, so this show, I would not invest. This is about as anonymous as it gets, getting the band back together. I mean, John Rando is directing. He's talented. The writer of the show is producer John Davenport, who has produced a lot of shows. This is his writing debut, certainly on Broadway. The songs are by Mark Allen, also making his Broadway debut, and somebody I don't know. You've got journeyman actors in the show like Mitchell Jarvis and Kelly Barrett. The biggest star in the show is Mary Lou Henner. It just sounds like, you know, a very anonymous production. It's a labor of love for them. You know, if you go see it and you love it, great. You know, stranger things have happened, but am I putting my money in it sight unseen? No way.
Okay, what about Pretty Woman, the musical? This is, again, bowing in August 16th. Broadway spin on the smash hit film starring Julia Roberts. Of course, this the musical won't, but the film did.
Yeah, Pretty Woman, the musical, I will not invest in. The director and choreographer is Jerry Mitchell, who just did Kinky Boots. That's one of the biggest hits of all time. The songs are by Brian Adams and his longtime songwriting partner. And it stars Samantha Barks, who's going to be, you know, who's going to be making, I think, maybe her Broadway debut, or certainly this is her biggest role. They've just recast the male lead. It's now Andy Carl, who did great in Groundhog Day. People like him a lot. He's an interesting choice. It may turn Samantha Barks into a star, but I don't think it's going to click as a musical.
Bernhardt Hamlet, September 25th. Janet McTeer stars in a world premiere production of a new play by Teresa Rebeck about actress Sarah Bernhardt tackling Hamlet in 1899. It's at the Roundabout Theater. Buy your tickets early. Are you going to invest or not invest?
Would I invest or not invest in Bernhardt Hamlet? Weirdly, I think I might invest. Obviously, I'd love to read it and see, you know, read the play and see the show, but it's got a great showcase for an actor of a certain age. Janet McTeer is a great actor. Assuming you got a piece of the show and can have a piece of that in touring and productions and revivals down the road, it sounds like a really juicy, fun theater-type show that people are going to love. Actresses who are hungry for good lead roles. That's always the case. We've got a lot more great actresses than we do have parts for them. Certainly new plays coming out. So I'm tempted to invest. That's a real roll of the dice, but I'm going to do it.
What about The Nap? Maybe not a good name for a show. September 27th at the Manhattan Theater Club. It's a new comedy about the world of snooker. It's by Richard Bean, who wrote One Man, Two Governors. Features a pool table on stage with a competition taking place live in London. I guess it's a play. It starred Mark Addy as shady dad of our competitive player hero, directed by Daniel Sullivan. Invest or not invest?
Well, now remember, One Man, Two Governors was a big hit on Broadway and really in London as well. It helped turn James Corden into an even bigger star and helped launch him into his TV career. I'm intrigued to see the show The Nap, which, yeah, not a good name for a show. It does sound like you want a ticket, but it's a fun, loud show. But it's not still running in London. You know, if it was still running in London, I'd say, oh, wow, look at that. It sounds like it's really clicked. But, you know, it's come and gone, even though it got quite good reviews. I want to see it, but will I invest in it? No.
You know, it's not like they need the set, you know, it's like The Ferryman on October 21st. It's a new play by Jez Butterworth and directed by Sam Mendes. It'll star Patty Considine, Laura Donnelly, and it got tremendous reviews. It won the Olivier for best play. Will you invest or not invest?
I'm not sure if people made money off Jez Butterworth's last play on Broadway. That was Jerusalem. Boy, you know, I would invest in it, though. It got such good reviews. Everyone I know who saw it in London loved it, thought it was absolutely tremendous. If you've got a piece of this play down the road, you know, you got to remember the deals that you get when you're investing on Broadway. Are you just a schmucky little guy like me with a couple $100,000 to toss in? You know, you may get a piece of the Broadway production, but not touring, or maybe touring, but not international. Maybe you don't get a piece of the show when it's done again and again down the road. The more rights you have, the more you want to invest. If I've got a piece of this Jez Butterworth play in perpetuity, absolutely.
The Waverly Gallery on October 25th. It's a revival of a Kenneth Lonergan play starring Michael Cera, Lucas Hedges, and Elaine May. That's an interesting cast. Invest or not invest?
That's a very interesting cast. So now this is a revival. So, you know, all the questions that you had about The Ferryman, a new play coming to Broadway, you're not going to get the rights to the Waverly Gallery for, you know, new revivals down the road. Those already have been sold off. So all you're investing in really is this current production and perhaps a touring production. But these actors aren't going to stick with it. Michael Cera did Lobby Hero. I really liked that revival. I thought it was good. I'm excited to see Lucas Hedges on stage. Elaine May, I'm just puzzled and intrigued by. But would I invest in it? No. It's a limited run. They all have other things to do. You're not getting a piece of the show. I really want to see it, but I am not going to invest in it.
You know, I almost feel like I don't need to read out the next one. Torch Song will premiere on November 1st. It's a revival of the Harvey Fierstein play starring Michael Urie and Mercedes Rule. It's got a limited run through February 24th. It's not even going to run through the Tonys, so I get the feeling you're probably not going to invest, but what do you say?
I kind of really want to invest in Torch Song, even though for all the reasons you say, it doesn't seem like a good idea. I don't know why it would not be scheduled to run through the Tonys. What's the point of reviving it and having it close in mid-February? That doesn't make any sense, except maybe Michael Urie's schedule is too jam-packed.
I was just going to say that's a scheduling issue.
But he's Michael Urie. He's not, he should have cleared his schedule and been ready to run at least through the Tonys. Dear God, you know, it ran off Broadway. I saw it. It was very good. You know, the original Torch Song was a phenomenon. Is this one going to run for a year? That would be a really long time. I wouldn't think so. But it's also a part now that people say, okay, it doesn't have to be Harvey Fierstein in this role. Could another actor take it over and do a really great job with it too? Absolutely. And I'd be intrigued to see that happen. It's a big, juicy part, and you could get a really good name that would want to run with this for another 6 months. You know, but like for all the reasons you say, I guess I'm going to have to say not invest. If Michael Urie was there through the Tonys, I'll invest.
Okay, this next one, Bows on November 8th. And I'm just going to say the title and whether ask you whether you'll invest or not invest. King Kong.
God, no. God, no. King Kong. I am not investing in King Kong. There's not a chance in hell I'm going to invest in King Kong. It's directed by Drew McConey. I don't know how to say his name, but he's a UK director making his Broadway debut. He did Strictly Ballroom. He won the Olivier for directing In the Heights. That was a big, visible project there in the UK. The songs are by Maurius DeVries, the Grammy-winning producer and songwriter. It stars a giant ape, and I would never invest in it in 1,000 years. I wouldn't even invest in a ticket.
The Prom, November 15th is when you can start seeing this particular, I don't know whether if it's a musical. Yeah, I guess it's a musical. It's directed and choreographed by Casey Nicholaw of Mean Girls, Aladdin and Something Rotten, The Book of Mormon. It stars Beth Leavell and Christopher Seiber. It's co-written by the guy behind The Drowsy Chaperone. Oh, I like that one. It's songs by the guy behind Elf the Musical. Over the Hill.
All right.
It's about Over the Hill Broadway stars who see a chance for publicity when a lesbian can't bring her date to the prom in a small conservative town. Invest or not invest?
You know, for a long time, The Prom sounded as anonymous and boring as Getting the Band Back Together or some of these other shows. You're thinking like, why is this? You know, it really should have started off Broadway. It sounds like a show that would have been better served by being off Broadway. But you know what? It played out of town and it got pretty good reviews. And people said it's a lot of fun. It's sort of a Valentine to Broadway. It's goofy. It's silly. Everybody can identify with The Prom and the lesbian girl wanting to bring her date to the high school prom. People can, that's in the news all the time. And it's goofy and it's fun and it's a comedy. And it's stars that aren't going to cost a lot. I don't like Elf the Musical. I never saw The Drowsy Chaperone, but I do have a lot of faith in Casey Nicholaw. So I think I'm going to invest.
Ooh, okay. Well, this next one, it's called The Cher Show, and it's C-H-E-R, okay?
Cher.
December 3rd, okay? It's directed by Jason Moore of Pitch Perfect and Avenue Q. Stephanie Block et al. Will be Cher and Jared Spector as Sonny Bono. It's Cher, for Pete's sakes. Invest or not invest?
I'd be afraid not to invest in the Cher show because none of my gay friends would ever speak to me again. Plus, who doesn't want to go to the after party?
That's true. However,
in my heart of hearts, after seeing Donna Summer the Musical, I kind of don't want to invest in the Cher show. I mean, I'd really like to see it. And it played out of town and they think it's got needs work, but it can happen. I'm scared of it. But, and really my mind says don't invest in it. So I'm going to just say not invest and hope Cher doesn't hit me.
Okay, this next one, I have a feeling I know what you're going to say. To Kill a Mockingbird. Okay, it opens December 13th. It's a play starring Jeff Daniels, adapted by Aaron Sorkin, and it's going to be directed by Bartlett Sher. So are you going to invest or not invest?
To Kill a Mockingbird. I think Scott Rudin is involved, so by nature I would not invest because you're not going to get a good deal with Scott around. But it's philosophically, I think I would invest. It's such a great name brand play. It's the first time it's been done, so I assume you're going to get a piece of it on the road and down the road, certainly at least touring. It's Jeff Daniels, so it is a star turn, but I think it's an easily recast role. And, you know, you want to say you trust Aaron Sorkin's instincts. It's very commercial, obviously. And possibly, if you're talking about the zeitgeist, maybe there's just a thirst for decency, a hero that is stalwart and upright and true. And, of course, in this case, we know that the character he plays is more racist and learns to become a better person. So he's not just the straight arrow that Gregory Peck was in the movie. He becomes a better person while we watch the show. But given that name brand and the possibility of a juicy role for lots of actors who are going to want to step into it, I am going to invest.
Oh, that's exactly what I thought you would say.
Well, I was torn, but invest it is. So we'll have to see how I do 6 months or a year down the road.
If we can remember what episode this actually appeared on.
That's right.
But we thank you for investing the last, I don't even know how long this show will wind up being. But thank you for taking the time to listen to our show each and every week. And you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to our show or rate and review the show. You can find links to those sources as well as links to ways you can contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to follow us on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
I really do love share.com.
Okay, that's good to know. But
don't yell at me.
Okay, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com to read some of his coverage? You know, all of his work is aggregated there. I would say you could find out what you should be reading at bookfilter.com, but apparently not.
You can. Absolutely. Okay. The best book of the week is there's a small country, a book by a French hip hop star about his childhood growing up in Africa, right near Rwanda and Zambia, and dealing with genocide. It's lovely and gripping and sad and really, really good.
Well, okay. Check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. And until 2 weeks from now, play nice.
Okay, Sperling, everybody's gone away. Everybody's gone home now. So tell me the story about when you kissed Roseanne.
Oh, okay. This was it was 1995, 96. It was a New Year's Eve party in at the House of Blues. Was brand new. It was on Sunset Boulevard, and they had this room called the Foundation Room. And it was where, like, all the VIPs got to go. You know, it was supposedly the people who had invested would get to go and sit in the Foundation Room. And I was at a New Year's Eve party, and, you know, midnight struck, and I was standing next to Roseanne, and she just turned to me and went, "Oh, aren't you the cutest thing?" and just grabbed me and kissed me. And I was just like, all my friends teased me about this mercilessly for years afterward.
And this is the show still on the air.
She's still very successful.
Well, there you go. You've kissed a racist.
Wait a second. That should be the name of our next show.
That's right. Oh, and if anybody's still listening, by the way, one of the heads of Nickelodeon just stepped down. Sima Zargami. I apologize for not knowing how to say her first name, Cyma. She started as a scheduling clerk at Nickelodeon and rose to become one of the top leaders in children's television. And she's leaving them after more than 30 years. You know, this comes on the heels of Dan Schneider being fired, essentially, from Nickelodeon. We still don't know why he left. And now the head of Nickelodeon is leaving. I don't assume they're related in any way, shape, or form, but there's a lot going on at Nickelodeon I don't understand.
It's all about SpongeBob.
It's all about SpongeBob. Goodbye.